maybe it's welcome back. You've checked in or stumbled upon the Newport Storytellers podcast, and we are so happy that you have. This is episode 9 of what is growing into a 10-part series of stories and music from Newport, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, west side of the Yarra River, or Birrarung, the River of Mists. And we're your hosts, Matt MacArthur and
Jackie Cowan. Our audio adventure is recorded and edited on the unceded lands of the Bunurong, and we acknowledge their unbroken connection to country that has long been mapped by story, song and dance.
And we pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and to the elders of all nations, and to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who may be listening.
And Matt, all the contributors to our podcast, if not in the 3015 postcode, are either close by or they are supporters of our regular storytelling and music gatherings that take place under the broad wings of the Newport Fiddle and Folk Club. So what's the plan for this episode? Is there a plan?
Jackie, there is always a plan. Sort of. We're going to begin with a discussion with Lana Wolfe, who describes herself as a story worker rather than a storyteller. And we'll finish with Dharma, with a no-nonsense song. Yes, I know we said we'd conclude each ep with a nonsense song, but what we say and what we do is a tad rubbery. So Jackie, this episode is breaking with the pattern.
Yes, we are breaking with the pattern for this episode. Normally we have 2 10-minute stories, but when Cameron and I were recording Lana talking about her work in the Pacific and Southeast Asia, we became so engrossed with what she had to say, it turned into a 20-minute session. So for this episode, we'll play the full interview and drop a story. Also, we won't have a singer-songwriter either. As for this ep, Dharma's choice of song is particularly interesting, and we decided to give her the time to sing it for us and tell us how it came to be.
Fair enough. Let's get into it.
Yes, let's. Cameron Sharp from Loosh Budgie Productions came over to my house one Sunday in March and set up his gear in the sunroom. And we spent the afternoon recording stories and songs. As you already said, Matt, Lana describes herself as a story worker rather than a storyteller, and what follows is a conversation with Lana about her work with Edge Effect in the environmentally volatile Pacific. Edge Effect came into being in response to the fact that disaster managers do not, at present, consider LGBTIQ plus people in humanitarian and development aid. But enough of me, let's listen to Lana. So we have Lana Wolfe on the other end of the microphone. How's my ABC voice today? Do you reckon that's ABC? Cam's giving me the thumbs up. Cam's recording and he keeps telling me I have an ABC voice. However, it's not about me. I've got Lana Wolfe with me, and Lana and I haven't seen each other for 2 years except through a Zoom screen, I think would be.
No, about a year ago you came home for dinner.
Oh, that's
in
right.
In that little break.
Oh, and
of...
we did have in lockdowns. We went to that concert in Footscray.
Oh, yes.
There was that twice. We've seen each other twice.
Yes.
So we talked about we emailed about what story you were going to do for us today, for us to record. And when you arrived, you said, well, I've changed my mind.
Yes.
So I'm happy with that. Let's go with the flow. I trust your judgment. Can you tell us what the story is and then tell us the story?
Well, maybe first of all I'll tell you that I'm coming today not as a storyteller but as a story worker. Mm-hmm. And that the story that I'll be sharing today is one that is a story that everybody in this room, I think, would know, and many people listening would know. But it's really the story behind the story that's captured my attention. And it's the story of Noah's Ark.
Oh, right. So we can expect floods.
We can expect floods.
We can expect gender. No, not necessarily.
Well, a little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the story goes that at the very beginning of time, God created Adam and Eve, that Eve sinned by eating an apple, and that a bit of chaos happened, but God forgave because he was forgiving. And then a long, long, long time passed. And God looked around and saw there was lots of sin in the world, that the world was full of wicked, evil people. And God decided that this was no good, that he needed to cleanse the world of evilness. But he also acknowledged and recognized that there was one person that revered God, that loved God, that was not full of wickedness, and this person was Noah. And so God said to Noah, "The world is full of wickedness and I will be rid of it. I want you to build an ark and I want you to get a pair of every animal, of every bird, of every insect, of every bug, put it into the ark with lots of food, and I will wipe the earth clean of sin." Noah, obeying God, was getting one of each animal, of each bird, of each bug, bringing them to the ark. He was also telling others, you need to clean yourself of sin or else God will wipe us all away. But everybody laughed at Noah. They didn't pay him any heed. And so once Noah had gotten all of the pairs of animals, all of the pairs of birds, all of the pairs of bugs onto the ship, Noah, his wife, their three sons, and their sons' wives aborted the ship, and the storm came and it started to rain. And it rained and it rained and it rained. It rained for 7 days and seven nights. Once the rain had stopped, the floods kept rising, and they rose and they rose and they rose. And for months upon months upon months, the world was covered in water. As far as the eye could see, or Noah could see, was the sea. So Noah decided that he would send out a raven into the world to see if the raven could find any sign of land, but the raven didn't return. A week later, God sent out a dove to see if it could find land. The dove went out and got so tired from not finding any land, it returned. Another week passed and Noah sent out the dove again. And this time the dove came back with an olive branch, and Noah knew that at least the branches of the trees were now above the waterline. So Noah, his wife, their sons and wives, and all of the animals stayed on that ark until finally the floods had receded and the land started to dry out. Bible stories tell us that this was many, many months, up to maybe a year and a half of floods. And they tell us that once the ark had landed, that the floods receded, Noah prayed to God and thanked him for his mercy, for keeping them alive. And God made a rainbow appear in the sky, promising that the floods would never happen again. And that's a story that you're probably very familiar with, aren't you, Jax?
I am very familiar with that story, yes.
Yeah. I first remember hearing that story when I was very, very little in Sunday school.
Yeah, and in all toy shops today, you can go in and find arcs and animals. And yeah, it's very, very much part of our culture.
It is. Although growing up and going to church and having a Christian family, I got to a point when I was about 14 that even though I would pray, it just felt really empty. I realized that I, within myself, didn't believe. So I stopped going to youth group and I stopped going to church, and it just became a story in the back of my mind. When my children were young, I did buy them, you know, Christian stories, but those stories sat on the bookshelf beside Greek myths and Norse myths and Indian myths, and I didn't think much about it. I didn't think much about it until I was back in Fiji in the end of 2016 researching the experiences of people with diverse sexual orientations and gender identities in their experience post-Cyclone Winston, to find out what their experiences were in disasters and recovering from disasters like cyclones.
And it was, so I just interrupt. So this is after Cyclone Winston. So how many months after that were you there?
I can't remember. I went a few times.
Yeah.
So it was research over.
It was close over to about the time. A year.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, yeah. Afterwards, meeting up with people. LGBT people is what the term would use in Australia.
Yeah.
Meeting up with different groups in different villages and different areas across Fiji. And it was really interesting because although I was looking for information about technical humanitarian response, what I kept hearing was that they were being blamed for the cyclone. And I would have Talanoa sessions with them, which is this very traditional type of storytelling sessions, to find out what stories were happening, what stories they were hearing, what stories they were telling about themselves, and what stories they were connecting with as a community. And what kept on coming up was this story of Noah, how many community members in Fiji as Christians believe and know and see and witness every single day that the oceans are rising, that the islands are going under.
So they're witnessing very directly.
They're witnessing very directly climate change. They're experiencing more and more tropical cyclones at greater rates, at stronger intensity, more frequently.
And there are some people, while they're witnessing this, they're seeking to find a reason or a cause, and they're looking at the LGBTQI plus community and laying blame at the feet of those people.
Yeah.
Wow. And
so this is the really powerful thing about stories. Stories are things that help us understand and know the world. They're the way in which people communicate with each other. We share stories, whether it's what I had for dinner last night turns into a story.
Yeah.
Last time we met each other turns into a story. Mm. And how we understand the world, how we understand climate change, how we understand our positions in society are told through stories.
Can I wind back to the Noah story? We know that God said to gather one of each, meaning one male and one female. Mm. So is there a link to that part of the story and that instruction to the non-recognizing or valuing the lives of people who are non-binary?
That hasn't come up in my research, but it's really interesting because these are stories that are prevalent across the Pacific where I do a lot of my research, but they're also prevalent in places like Australia, like America. In all disasters, we do have one or two religious leaders, often of right-wing persuasion, call out and say it's the sinners that have done this. It's LGBT people. And it's interesting because what I hear from many people is that Christianity is tradition in the Pacific. And sometimes that tradition sees people with diverse genders in their cultures. So, for example, you might be very familiar with in Samoa Fafafini. But sometimes in places like Fiji, where colonialism and Christianity has been really embedded in society, often it's a lot harder to see those traditional third gender folk, traditional genders and diverse sexual orientations as
well. This is such an interesting conversation to have because in Hobson's Bay we're just about to enter into Diversity Week where our local councillors will be running free workshops. I mean, by the time this podcast is edited and uploaded, it will have passed. But it's worth noting that local councils consider it important enough to run free workshops for people. We also celebrate Midsummer Festival over here, and we also celebrate many island communities in the area. Now, I know that my friend here, Cam, who is recording this for us, when we talked to you before he pressed record, he was absolutely fascinated by what you had to say. And Cam, is there anything you would like to ask Lana that she hasn't addressed or that I haven't asked her?
No, I think it was just quite interesting actually hearing it. It was, I mean, I guess before the podcast we were talking about what you do and working with sort of humanitarian aid and how that there's that lack of, I guess, recognition of gender diversity or sexual identity within disaster zones. And it was great for you to unpack some of that, and I'd love you to be able to share a bit more about that and just sort of, I guess, to me, when we were talking about it, it was really I see humanitarian aid as people, not gender identity or sexual identity. So can you unpack a little bit of that and just explain? You told me sort of it really was quite surprising to me that within that humanitarian world, which is aid into, I guess, areas that have been sort of disaster areas, I guess. Can you unpack a little bit about sort of what you found within that?
Yeah, so I guess the work that I do really focuses on the inclusion of LGBT people in humanitarian and development contexts. And we started this work because we saw that outside of development programming around HIV and AIDS, where there has been extensive work done across the world, that really not much has been happening at all. So we had to really start unpacking it. And this research that I was talking about, Down by the River, was our very first research project. But what we realized is that first responders are people in your own community. You know, when a cyclone hits, for example, and you're rushing to a shelter, that shelter might be in the Pacific, a Christian church, because it's the strongest building there, and many LGBT people might not feel comfortable and safe to go into that church. If there's a united response around shelter, different places do different things, but what might be common is that shelter will be segregated, for example, in a family. So you might, if you're a man and a woman and children, a nuclear family, a heteronormative nuclear family, you might go to one place. If you don't fit into that, you might be designated as single, even if you're not. And so you might be placed in different shelters. So you might not be able to actually be with your family because your family's not recognized. When a humanitarian disaster happens, what the aid system will do is do what's called a rapid needs assessment. And so that rapid needs assessment will ask you all sorts of things, including your sex, your age, and if you have a disability, and then be able to imply lots of things and ask lots of things about shelter, water sanitation, hygiene, and all sorts of things from that. But what it does do is assume that sex and gender are exactly the same thing. It assumes that a family is heteronormative. It assumes that the gender that you have is the one assigned at birth. It assumes that men can't have families and households together, or that women might have families and households together, or that trans folk might have families and households together. And so what our research has shown, for example, is in the Indian Ocean tsunami, aid workers came in, they had to tick a male or female box, and the local community of Aravani, which is assigned male at birth but very feminine presenting, couldn't tick a male or female box. They're not men, they're not women, they're Aravani. And what happens was that because they couldn't complete the rapid needs assessment, they weren't able to get shelter. They weren't able to get food. They weren't able to get water. Their deaths weren't recorded. Because the local community saw the aid system discriminating against them, the local community continued to discriminate against them more. What we see is that in many places where before an emergency, if there's a lot of stigma and discrimination, they're not being able to finish school because of bullying, they're not being able to get good jobs because they're discriminated in that area. You know, they might have unstable housing, no savings in the bank. And so all of these things lead up to a very precarious situation when a disaster happens, it becomes incredibly difficult. And then post-disaster, they're starting from way, way behind and often unrecognised.
Because I guess it's a balance between that quick response within a disaster versus acknowledging non-binary gender or non-heteronormative identities. So is that what you're working towards, is getting into that space where there is a lot more acknowledgement of non-binary or non-heteronormative up front, so that there isn't that discrimination?
Well, what I guess first and foremost, it's about ensuring that crisis-affected LGBT communities mm-hmm. have their needs, rights and strengths acknowledged and able to flourish in this space. And it's interesting because a lot of that has to happen before a disaster, you know. And the piece of research that I'm doing, which is a follow-up to Down by the River, was not only to bring LGBT people and faith leaders together, but the story that was missing here was the story of climate scientists, so bringing climate scientists and climate activists in and being able to unpack different stories, being able to unpack stories of pre-preparedness. And it was so wonderful to hear stories around pre-preparedness to do with traditional knowledge. So, for example, that if the bees are building their nest up in a tree, the cyclone season's not going to be very harsh. If the bees are building their nest down below, cyclones are going to come.
Yeah, wow.
Or if the banana leaves are pointing upwards, no cyclones in the near future. If they're pointing down, then we know a cyclone's coming. Mm. Or, you know, at certain times where it's not like when the waves are hitting the reefs mm-hmm. in Fiji, but it's not, you know, the tide coming in, tide coming out, you know that a big storm's coming.
Yeah, okay.
And
yeah.
So hearing and being able to work with communities to be able to build their own resilience and build their own way of disaster risk reduction, which is a technical term we would use, but also find ways to work together as a community, but then that flowing up to the humanitarian system. And we also work specifically with the humanitarian system so that they can eliminate their systemic discrimination that they're creating. So I work with communities using story work, but I also work with the humanitarian system using technical terms and doing more technical work.
Oh, Lana, I love the way you've taken us in a circle from telling us a story and talking about your story work and giving us examples of your work and then bringing us back to, again, raising your described role as story worker. There's going to be it's been amazing collecting the stories for the podcast. We've had so many different kinds of stories, traditional folk stories, Aussie yarns, stories encased encased. You'd say something's encased in music, do you? What do you say, Cam? Stories in song.
In song.
In song. Encased. That sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? We've had bilingual stories. And now we've been listening to you and how you actively use story to unpick even bigger stories. So I know people are going to be interested, and for people looking at the website, we have with every episode links for the curious, and we'll make sure I get lots of links from you, Lana, so that people can click on them and look deeper into the work that you are doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lana, for taking the time to talk to us about your work. Lana has been a supporter of the Victorian Storytellers over the years, dipping in and out of activities and volunteering for events as time is allowed, and she has been consistent in bringing awareness and understanding of people of diverse sexual orientation and gender identities to our community of chinwaggers. If you would like to learn more about Lana and the Edge Effect, there's a link on our podcast page. So it's back to another recording made in your sunroom, Jackie.
Sure is, Matt. This is Dharma singing Kilkelly Island. Dharma comes to all our storytelling gatherings, assists with hosting, and never fails to sing.
So, Dharma, I'm going to ask you if you could introduce the song that you're going to sing for us in a moment. I know it's one that I requested because it is such an amazing story song. And as we're Newport storytellers, one of the things that we ask when we have our gatherings is of musicians, as we ask them if they sing a song, please sing a song with a story. And this one's quite amazing. Would you like to tell us a little bit about it, please?
Yes, yes. Thanks, Jackie. Yeah, the song's called Kilkelly Island. So in the late 1970s, a bloke, Peter Jones, discovered a collection of century-old letters in his parents' attic in Maryland in the USA. And the letters had been sent by his great-great-grandfather, Brian Hunt, to his son, Jones's great-great-grandfather, John Hunt. And he'd emigrated from Kilkelly, County Mayo, to the United States in 1855 and then worked on the railroads. And as Brian was illiterate, the letters were dictated by the local schoolmaster, Pat McNamara, who often wrote letters on behalf of his neighbours who were unable to read and write. And it's just a story that covers the years, I think it's 1858 to 1892, so about over a good 30 years. And the letters just share the family news of births and deaths and marriages and the reports of the annual harvest. And the last letter, dated February 1892, was written by John's Hunt brother. And so Peter Jones found these letters and decided to make a ballad of the song.
Kilkelly Island in 1860, my dear loving son John. Good friend, the schoolmaster, Pat McNamara, is so good to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England, house is so empty inside. The cropper of potatoes is sorely infected, a third to the half of them bad. And your sister, Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell, going to be married in June. Mother says not to work on the railroad, be sure to come home soon. Kilkelly Island in 1870, dear loving son John. Hello to you, missus, and all to your children, may be healthy and strong. And Michael has got in a wee bit of trouble, I guess he never will learn. Because of the dampness, there's no turf to speak of, and now we have nothing to burn. And Bridget is happy you named a child for her, now she has six of her own. Thank you for sending your family pictures, they're lovely young women and men. Kilkelly Island in 1880, dear Michael and John, my sons. I'm sorry to give you the very sad news that your dear old mother has gone. And we buried her down in the church in Kilkelly, your brothers and Bridget were there. You don't have to worry, she died very quickly, remember her in your prayers. So good to hear that Michael's returning with money he's sure to buy land. For the crop has been poor and the people are selling for any price that they can. Kilkelly Island in 1890, my dear loving son John. Guess that I must be close on to 80, it's 30 years since you're gone. And because of all of the money you sent me, I'm still living here on me own. Michael has built himself a fine house, Bridget's daughters have grown. And thank you for sending your family picture, they're lovely young women and men. You say that you might even come for a visit. What joy it would be see you again. Kilkelly Island in 1892, my dear brother John. I'm sorry that I didn't write any sooner to tell you that father's passed on. He was living with Bridget. She said he was cheerful and healthy right down to the end. And I should have seen play the grandchildren of Pat McNamara, your friend. And we buried him alongside his mother down at the Kilkelly churchyard. He was a strong and feisty old man, considering his life was so hard. And it's funny the way he kept talking about you. He called to you right till the end. Oh, why don't you think about coming to visit? Love to see you again.
So, Matt, that's the end of episode 9 of the Newport Storytellers podcast. Episode 10 will be our final episode, so come dressed up and bring a plate for the after party.
I look forward to it. This podcast was made possible by the support of Hobsons Bay City Council through its Make It Happen grants program. And for that, we are very grateful.
And we thank the Newport Fiddler and Folk Club, under whose auspices we bloom, and the storytellers and musicians who've joined us on this adventure. Please explore the links on our page for more information about the storytellers and musicians. And if you haven't already, visit the Newport Fiddler and Folk Club website and go for a wander. Lots of fun things to do. nffc.org.au.
Lana Wolfe and Dharma were recorded by Cameron Sharp from Loosh Budgie Productions. Jackie kept us all on task and wrote our scripts. And I assembled the stories and songs in my studio in Point Cook.
And thank you, Bruce Williams, for allowing us to include your tune, Road to Lewisburg, as our theme. Please, if you've enjoyed listening, spread the word. Stories and music are for sharing. So, one more episode to go, Matt.
It's been a challenge navigating the uncharted COVID universe. And a learning curve.
Indeed, it has been a challenge, but immensely satisfying.